Karl Jaspers, in his book on Marx, the one I'm referring to as Reason and Anti-Reason.
In his book on whom?
On Marx, Reason and Anti-Reason.
Oh, yeah.
He stated in that book that the assumption that history was, in its essence, progressive, and that therefore the ends justify the means, rested on mistakenly connecting two terms, dialectic and causality. My question is that if one makes this connection between dialectic and causality, is it inevitable that one will also make the connection between violence and power?
That's a very good question. And give me one moment. I'm afraid, yes. You know, I'm afraid that wherever you have this dialectical continuity in which nothing new can happen except, you know, that everywhere there you have violence as a kind of marginal phenomenon of power, you know, but still it's the same as power. The left sense, by which I mean all Hegelians, whether they are left or right. The left sense, violence is a marginal phenomenon of power. Yeah. Power is behind it. But it is the same. It's one of the modes, but a marginal mode. The right says, what is behind all power is violence. Let's face facts. Let's be realists. Our power ultimately is violence, you know? The assumption is the same. You know, as far as my problem goes, it doesn't matter. Because that is, their power becomes, so to speak, a marginal phenomenon, you know? You see that? So I'm afraid the answer is yes. But if you think about it and you come to a different conclusion, let me know. Yeah, quite. By racism, I don't mean, let's take the Jewish movements. There were many anti-Semites, let's say, throughout history. Yeah, there is many people who didn't like Jews. For all kinds of reasons, also for reasons of bodily features. This I would not call racism. This is partly antipathy, partly prejudice, etc. This you can change because it's an isolated phenomenon. When I see racism, there you had suddenly people who had no dislike of Jews whatsoever, but who had become convinced of the argumentation of racist theorists. And this is no longer a kind of feeling. This is a kind of, not rationalizing, but it is really a kind of reasoning. And there, this kind of reasoning has a logic of its own, and the logic is murderous. The logic is murderous, you know. Then you say, if you agree about this or that, the scientific assumption, then it follows from it that this and that should happen. If you agree that Jews are a bad part of mankind as a whole, then you must, no matter what your feelings are, agree that Jews should be exterminated. And now, if you have friendly feelings towards the Jews, you should overcome them. You see, that is racism. And that is something altogether different from saying, I don't like Jews, I don't like Negroes, my sister shouldn't marry either, you know, and anything of that kind. That is only opinion. But an opinion and an ideology are really two different things. What I am afraid of is this. See, violence needs justification. And I am afraid that if a real black-white race struggle would break out in this country, both sides would feel that they need justification for what they are doing. And then the justification would be racism. And then the whole thing would really become murder. You know, much more murderous than occasionally riots from interest groups here or there. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. No. Mannheim use of the term ideology really comes still from experiences long before we actually knew what ideologies are. See, Mannheim formulated ideology and utopy, you know, in the early 20s. I know it because I was, so to speak, around, you know, not in the late 20s. You know, I knew him quite well. But he did not yet have either the Stalin or the Hitler experience. And to understand the real murderousness of ideology, this particular side of it, and then to define it according to these phenomena, you really needed the totalitarian experience of the 30s. I didn't understand that. Yeah, no. That is the way Marx used the word. Now, if you use it, we use the word differently. We say an ideology is every doctrine which tries to explain everything from one single idea and to have a key in its hand for the full clarification and illumination of everything there is. You know, that is finally the full development of ideology. The way Marx, you know, the term was first used in Napoleon I, you know. He spoke of the ideologue. But, and then the thing slowly developed, the verb and the term, you know. And it was then used by Marx, Mannheim sharpened the use in which Marx used it, yeah, the way in which Marx used it. And then actually what it really was came to the fore only in the 30s, in the totalitarian regimes, where really ideology for the first time as such played a decisive role in the body politic. That is where it was not just used to justify this object or the other, you know, single. You could, for instance, kill the Duc d'Enghien, as Napoleon did, and then justify it or excuse it with a reason of state. Yeah, that was one single item, you know. Whereas here, ideology goes through the whole body politic. This was never there before, in the sense of a national socialism or a communism. I don't mean that See, National Socialism used anti-Semitism as a chief ideology. Now, anti-Semitism existed, of course, before. Before it was used in its in this sense. So communism, socialism existed before Stalin used it. But only in this, when I talk about a fully developed ideology, I mean that it is in this way politicalized, so to speak. It is in the body politic. And this you have, for instance, to give just one more example. See, you had in Germany something very curious. And at first glance, really very ridiculous. Every German, in order to say that he is a German, had to prove negatively that he was not a Jew. Now, imagine 70 million people against 500,000, yeah? And now everybody had to show his ancestors, yeah? There you have it, how ideology becomes an institution in totalitarian state. And only then do I speak of fully developed ideology. Hmm? Yeah, you come later. No, we don't call that. Look, you call all these things, you, pardon? No, I wouldn't know. If faith is a religion, is not an ideology. Look, all these terms we use here, ideology, imperialism, totalitarian, dictatorship, tyranny, etc. All these words are used in a very loose way. You will hear that if somebody is not, for instance, some president of a university is in disagreement with the students and he is being accused of being totalitarian. Well, the most he could be was being tyrannical. More he couldn't even, you know, even if he wanted to, he simply couldn't. And so we use all these words in specific, well-defined ways. Because otherwise they apply to so many phenomena that they have no, you know, they are like an umbrella under which you can put everything, and they have no longer, you do no longer know what you are actually talking about. We want always to know, when we use a term, the real phenomenon, down to earth, we are talking about. Then we use a term as a kind of shorthand. But this we cannot do if we have not first matched them as it were, you know? Yeah. Look, I will say this. I don't know, but I will say this. Republics and democracies existed before the party system. You know. What? Well, in antiquity, in America, in France, do you know how old the party system is? No. Well, I don't know who told you that. The party system originated about 130 years ago. These were the first beginnings of it, and actually developed at the end of, from the middle to the end of the 19th century. That is the truth of it. That is, the moment you talk about the party system, one thing, what we have today as a party system, one thing please be absolutely clear about, that we talk about a very recent phenomenon. Now, we, no. Yeah, that, but this, I'm afraid we cannot answer, but because this is you can use the word party again in a very loose way, and then it will apply everywhere. You can, you know, not only to the party to which we go and drink whiskey, but also there are several parties, namely people of different opinions. Parties in the sense of party bureaucracies in order to make possible election for office, and in the sense of representative government is one of the, and please try to read the history about it in order to get clear about it. We cannot clear that up here. I mean, that is the, yeah, what do you want? You want to say something? Actually, this has, in my opinion, nothing to do with the class business. It has to do with bureaucracy. And bureaucracy, unfortunately, developed everywhere, in every single sphere of our life. And once a bureaucracy has developed, it is very difficult to get rid of it. But one thing is clear. Our problem is representative government, and we have very little notion of what we actually mean by representation. But that this election methods, which we have, and which originally came up with the party that then developed into bureaucracy, this election system is not necessarily the only way to elect representatives. It is one way. And it would be worthwhile, or there was one other thing proposed ever, and that is, of course, a council system, which has an altogether different principle, but has within itself also the principle of representation. Now, which is necessary because, as I said, the room will not hold all. But they all participate in one way or another. Now, whether this system would work, we don't know. Each time it came up, it was pitched already against parties, particularly since the Russian Revolution. And all parties have, first of all, every organization has one thing that makes it tick. It does not want to disappear. So the parties immediately fought for their very life and survival. And up to now, either the right or the left has defeated this other possibility. But this does not mean that it is possible. I don't see it. That is, I don't deny the totalitarian systems, but there's something else plays a much bigger role than the party, and the secret services, but let's not go into that. Yeah.
I think I see the connection between Jasper's statement and my question and something you said during your lecture. But I think what he was trying to say is that those people who connect history and progress, causality and dialectic, what they're trying to do is they're trying to describe a process, and they're saying that this process has its cause within itself. Isn't this precisely what those people who define violence as power or define violence as an organic function, isn't this precisely what they're doing? For they're not describing what violence is, but they're getting around it by implying that it has its cause within itself and moving it on its
own. That's perfect. That's perfectly true. That is what you actually have to snap out of the thought process and thinking, you know. That is, of course, what it are. And these processes, just to underline once more, are almost always thought of as biological, organic processes. As though if we act and something happened that could follow in any way these natural, you know, these natural laws. And it would really be important to, it's very difficult to talk even about these things and to eliminate, as I try, all organic metaphors, because they have crept into our language. That's a very good story. And actually started already with Aristotle, if not with Plato. It is not only an old story, but it seems such an easy way, you know? And if you begin to think about it, you see it's murder. Yeah? You? All right. You hear? I said that these people said that I quoted John Stuart Mill. And John Stuart Mill said man has one inclination, that is to command, and one disinclination, that's to obey. And I would say that man has at least a third inclination, namely to obey. And that is by no means a disinclination. And I that is that this is much stronger in human psychology than these people think it is, you know? No, I say most people basically want to obey, and I said one more step. I said those who want to obey usually also want to a command, you know? That usually goes together. You want to if you want to read the classical passage on this, please read Herodotus, the third book, chapter 80 following. That is the first discussion of the forms of government. And there you hear finally one man who does not want to become king because he says, I don't want to rule and I don't want to be ruled. And that is, of course, a spokesman in Herodotus for Athenian democracy. And Herodotus, somebody else was then chosen king, Darius was chosen king, and they have discussed which is the best form of government, monarchy, oligarchy, or democracy, you know, and he said, no rule. I don't want to rule. I don't want to be ruled. And then Herodotus adds, and his house remains the only free house in all of Persia. It is the perfect definition of what freedom. No, first. For instance, let's leave the Union of South Africa out. Yeah? And if you will, yeah. And I would say Franco-Spain, Italy, one-party dictatorships. Of course, we have the word fascism from there. All right, then let's call it fascism, but then let's call Hitler's dictatorships by some other word, you know? Because these are party dictatorships. And see, you see it immediately. If you want to apply it, you know, the one, as I see it, distinguishing feature is that the party immediately occupies the state apparatus. They put all the members into the government. Whereas all totalitarian systems have two, or at least more authorities, the party, the state, the elite group, the police, etc. You have always this this proliferation. Yeah? There you see that, and then you get new laws. But these laws are laws, they are not being changed. There's a law in Russia as well as in Stalin's Russia as well as in Nazi Germany, as you know, could change from day to day. There was no law. And that is it's a great difference. And I assure you, for your own well-being as an individual, it's very unpleasant to live under a dictatorship. Or a tyranny, or a one-party dictatorship, but it is paradise compared to living under a totalitarian dictatorship. This I don't say. I think rage is provoked by violence, by injustice. I said, the normal reaction, that is the normal reaction to injustice, is rage. It is not the normal reaction to suffering and misery as such. No. If an earthquake would shake now this, and we would very much suffer, you know, a real earthquake, you know, unlikely, I agree. Nobody will fly into a rage. And there may be as much suffering as from an atomic bomb if the earthquake is big enough. Yeah. What? Yeah, but that would be irrational. No. If a man's house goes down, an earthquake. If he is angry, he is insane. By the way, we know about these things so much that we know very well that people do not react with anger or with rage to such incidents. But that may be, then you have a bad temper, my dear. But that is not what we are. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't classify. Begin with. And you mean that man is good? I know. That is a proposition. And it is only one of the propositions, by the way, which Rousseau made. You know, you see only one side of Rousseau. Rousseau was a very interesting fellow. He could change his mind many times. I don't believe in that, you know. I don't believe in either the proposition man is evil or the proposition that man is good. I would say man has the capability of being either good or evil. And he usually is something in between. And the point of the matter is really not what I was talking here about inclinations, you know. You can go, inclinations you can enumerate until you are blue in the face, you know. You go and study psychology. And I took out just what was relevant to this question of command and obedience. And my only point was that will to power, which is so much taken for granted by everybody today, is by no means such a simple business, a will to power and will to submission are real and interconnected, but this we couldn't touch here, or just mention. So Rousseau really has no, let him leave him out. Let's leave him out. Let's not classify him. See, he is not one of my favorite authors, but after all, he is a great author. Let's not classify great authors.
I was wondering if you had an opinion on perhaps some of the reasons why Herbert Marcuse's works recently, within the last few years, have gained such widespread appeal.
Yeah, I think that's why, simply because of his life business. You know? Because Marcuse, who knows Marx quite well, and Hegel, and being combined, once more, Bergson and Marx, that's what he actually does. And just as Sartre tries today to combine existentialism and Marxism, and just as Sorel already tried to combine Bergson and Marx, you know, everywhere this attempt to combine the two, and it can be combined because of the curious organic metaphors in Marx's own work. Because of this business, violence is the midwife, and so on, you know, of history, etc. There is a common denominator, and the common denominator is, of course, our whole tradition. See, when you read treatises about power, you always will hear one thing, that power must grow. If it doesn't grow, it rots. It decays. It rots away. You know? Against this stands the great discovery of Montesquieu, that power can check power, and both powers that check each other can remain intact. You know? That is, that you can limit power without destroying it, which of course is one of the chief problems of all political science. Yeah. Yeah, look, of a yearning for. See, I wouldn't say of the last decades, but of the last few years, as a matter of fact. Because, see, you have the nationalism of ethnic groups that want to rise to nationhood. That's one thing, yeah? But you have something very curious. See, all the big nation states, England and France especially, where symbiosis in association of different ethnic tribes, of ethnic groups grew together into a nation. And this growing together actually made the nation state. That was a business that went over centuries until the nation state finally arose. And what we have now in the best established nation states, which certainly are France and England. You have in England, all of a sudden, the Scotch and the Welsh. Of course, they were always such fringe movements. And they were more or less the movements of the lunatic fringe. But now it's no longer. There's real trouble. And you have the same, de Gaulle wanted to split Canada. Well, before he knew what he was doing, the Provençal and the Breton told him that they want their own autonomous nations there, you know, in France. That is, if Paris and London, a centralized government and capitals, really if you really want to know what the capital is, you must know London and Paris, in political terms, and also in other terms. if these capitals cannot, if they're the center cannot hold anymore, you know, that is really something. It's not a cult. We don't know. We don't know, but it's very curious, isn't it? Yeah. A feudalism was the opposite. I mean, a feudalism, there you had small entities. You mean, is this a return to feudalism? No, I don't think so. Because after all, feudalism is also an economic system. And you cannot have feudalism in an urban civilization. See, you do not have this trouble in Denmark. You do not have such trouble in Holland. You have it in Belgium, but they are really, this is a very young nation, state, you know, I think 1800, what is it, I know, 1830, I think, or something, I'm not sure. But anyhow, last century, and rather artificial, just a piece of France and a piece of Holland were combined. So Belgium is really, you don't have it even in Switzerland. There are a few slightly insane people in Geneva, I guess, but these are real, this is more or less the lunatic fringe. You don't have it in some small countries. And for heaven's sake, in Switzerland, there are three different people living together in peace. And so you have it in the larger countries, and it's curious. It seems to me one of the cracks in bigness. So I thank you very much.